You're listening to True Crime Feed. Welcome to True Crime Feed. I'm your host, Angela Ferrari, here to review the best true crime podcast from the past decade with a teensy bit of humor, plus my top three true crime picks of the week. Today on the docket, a wild series from the archives I think you will not necessarily enjoy, but definitely find riveting. Let's discuss the case for I'm Not a Monster, Season 1 from the BBC. Here's a rundown from the show page. An American mother living in the heart of the ISIS caliphate, her husband an ISIS sniper, her 10-year-old son forced to threaten the U.S. president in a propaganda video shown all around the world. She claims she was tricked into taking her young children to war-torn Syria. But where does her account end and the truth begin? This is the story of one family's journey from Indiana to the Islamic State group and back. And to take your listening experience to the next level, go to thetruecrimefeed.com and sign up for my newsletter where I curate visual aids to accompany the show. The visuals are a must this week. Samantha Sally appears to be like the most normie norm mommy next door, and it makes her story all the more insane when you see where she ends up. My top shows later on in the podcast power ranking this week remind me of this story, so I thought it'd be an interesting one to revisit. I'm Not a Monster Season 1 does start out a little dry and underseasoned, typical for a BBC show, but then come episode 3, you are going to be feasting. Because our host, Josh Baker, delivers the goods. He's the kind of journalist that is literally throwing on a bulletproof vest and being smuggled into the most dangerous, conflict-ridden areas to document and report. And he's had more than a few near-death experiences, including that time he was sleeping in a shelter in northern Iraq when a bomb went off. The explosion fractured his spine and left shrapnel in his head. Dude is into some hardcore journalism. And I thought writing a blog post was tough. So yeah, we're gonna let Josh do all the heavy information gathering. But you and I still have two main objectives to complete by the end of this episode. Number one, rescue Samantha and her children from ISIS and get them back to America safely. Shouldn't be too hard. Then mission number two, find out who is the real Samantha Sally. Was she just an innocent American woman who was deceived and trapped by her abusive husband? Or a willing participant who knowingly put herself and her young children in harm's way? Again, our boy Josh is the one wearing the bulletproof vest, but it's still a good idea for us to throw on a poncho splash guard, because this story is like playing dodgeball with a bowl of chocolate pudding. We have to catch the truth and dodge the lies, hopefully get this all right. Otherwise, we might end up looking like a bunch of turd faces. So, how in the world did Samantha get herself into this position? Well, she grew up in Arkansas and her folks were devout Jehovah's Witnesses. So she and her sister Lori were raised very religious. In their teens, the two sisters distanced themselves from the church and both found their way into toxic relationships. Samantha gets married to an abusive man at the age of 16, but quickly divorces him. She then meets a man named Juan and has a child named Matthew with him, but the two also go their separate ways. The now single Samantha meets a dude named Musa El Hassani while working together at a delivery company called ViaDress, owned by Musa's family. More on this later. Musa's family, they were originally from Morocco and practicing Muslims, But Musa wasn't a strict follower of the faith. Samantha and Musa fell hard for each other. He woos her with gifts and romantic dates, and he's very sweet to her son, Matthew. Sam and Musa move in together and eventually get married. Neighbors recall the seemingly normal, happy couple. No signs of Islamic radicalization. In fact, when they first got together, Samantha had bleach blonde hair, tattoos, and a nose ring. Musa would lavish her with designer shoes and handbags. They both definitely enjoyed the finer things, driving around in a Porsche and a BMW. Although it wasn't always a smooth ride. Musa had a lot of vices. He would disappear for a few days, do some drugs, and sleep with the occasional prostitute. But Samantha wouldn't take this behavior lying down. After one such incident, she put up a big sign in their front yard that read, quote, "My husband would rather do cocaine and sleep with prostitutes than be with his family." Well, some good old-fashioned shaming seemed to do the trick, and Samantha and Musa made up. They had a daughter together, and then in 2015, they planned a nice, big, wholesome family vacation around the world. France, Hong Kong, and then spend a few months in Morocco with Moose's family. That way he could renew his visa and Samantha could get surgery on her knee at an affordable price. Lord knows you can't get that in America! The trip was going to be expensive. Musa started selling things to pay for it, including his treasured BMW to make this dream vacation happen. Then Musa, Samantha, and the two children left for Morocco. But first, they had a long layover in Istanbul. Samantha chalked it up to Musa getting a deal on some cheap airline tickets. While they were on their layover in Turkey, Musa suggested they go to the city of Şanlıurfa, a truly gorgeous city and popular tourist destination, and just a quick 13-hour drive away. Yeah. Şanlıurfa is a full 800 miles away from Istanbul, and it just so happens to be located on the border of Syria, which, I don't know if you guys remember, 2015 wasn't a great time to be anywhere near Syria, but Samantha still claimed she didn't know what was going on. Once the family arrived in Şanlıurfa, Musa met up with one of his brothers. Then Samantha said she and her two children were forced over the border into Syria. They made their way to the city of Raqqa, the then capital of ISIS. And seemingly overnight, Musa became a monster. Samantha was shocked. He had been concealing his descent into radicalization for months, maybe years, only now revealing his true self, a full-on believer in jihad. Now here in Raqqa, Syria, to join ISIS along with his brother and fight the holy war. Again, Samantha claimed she had zero clue Musa was a closeted ISIS fanboy this whole time. And now she's trapped in a house with her kids while Musa spends his days fighting as a sniper for the so-called caliphate. If she dared to venture out of the house, she must be covered from head to toe, not a sliver of skin exposed, or Samantha would be subject to beating. The fighting in the city is constant. Musa is gone a lot, but when he comes home, he is ruthless, increasingly more physically and sexually abusive to Samantha. Soon she's pregnant, desperate to get out. She tries to hire a people smuggler, but she's caught and punished, taken away to an ISIS prison for a few weeks while she's tortured. Despite this, though, she miraculously gives birth to a healthy baby. And shortly after that, she has another. At this point, Sam is completely reviled by Musa. So he decides to make it up to her, give his wife something to relieve the loneliness and take the burden off of her. A grand romantic gesture, ISIS style. Musa takes Samantha out to the market and tells her to pick herself out a nice teenage Yazidi slave girl. During the ISIS occupation of parts of Syria and Iraq, many Yazidi men were slaughtered and the women and children were sold into slavery. That day at the market, Samantha saw a girl named Sued and wanted to take her home. The two women became very close, but this meant that Sued was now also subject to rape and violence from Musa. He bought himself another 14-year-old Yazidi girl named Bedreen and a 7-year-old boy named Aham. Musa then took Samantha's son Matthew and Aham and used these little boys in ISIS propaganda videos. One infamous video shows Matthew taking apart a firearm and making a suicide bomb. In another scene, Matthew and Aham walk around in the rubble of Raqqa. Little Matthew, now going by the name Yusuf, recites a script that he's carefully memorized.
"We live in a small city called Raqqa. This city has scared the world because the Muslims who live in it have learned the meaning of jihad."
He goes on to threaten Jewish people, American people, and then President Donald Trump. In early 2017, this video went viral. It was on all the major news outlets. Everyone wanted to know the story about how an English-speaking American boy came to be the poster child for ISIS. Everyone, including reporter Josh Baker, who learned about the American family in ISIS-occupied Raqqa while he was still recovering in the hospital from the injuries he suffered from that bomb explosion in Mosul. Personally, I think he should have been milking his recovery. You know, enjoy a sponge bath, indulge in a few dozen ice cream cones, kick back and wait to receive your journalistic accolades. But instead, Josh patches up his various war wounds and heads back into the fire in search of answers. At this point, the fighting was ramping up in Raqqa. Samantha's house was hit by an explosive, nearly killing her and the kids. Then one day, Musa was out snipering and he was killed by a drone strike. So that's the end of him. In October 2017, the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces overtook the city of Raqqa from ISIS control in what was known as the Great Battle. At least, that's the official story. I heard a dirty little secret on the interwebs that the U.S. and the U.K. arranged a media blackout and secretly negotiated with ISIS leaders to reach a ceasefire and allow them safe passage out of the city. Can't say for sure, but I don't think we're going to find out the real story until Ridley Scott and or Jerry Bruckheimer make a blockbuster movie about it 20 years from now. And I'm sure said film will win an Oscar for Best Sound, aka Loudest Movie of the Year. Anyway, despite not knowing for sure how it all went down, we do know that on October 20th, 2017, the fighting was over in Raqqa. But the city was 80% uninhabitable. 270,000 people had been forced to flee. With unexploded IEDs and landmines everywhere, somehow Samantha and the kids managed to safely escape the city in a convoy. They were later captured by Syrian Kurdish military and detained so they could sort out if Samantha was an ISIS sympathizer or an innocent civilian. Hey now, that's what we want to know too! Reporter Josh Baker gets word of Samantha's escape and capture and tracks her down, following her trail from Al-Hasaka, Syria, to another undisclosed Syrian Kurdish military base. It's sketchy stuff, dude. Josh easily could have been killed or put in jail at any point along the way. The whole time I was like, geez, Joshua, you're taking all of these harrowing risks on your life just to make a podcast? The sketchiest podcast risk I've ever taken was that time I recorded an episode with a sleeping pug dog on my lap. Josh actually manages to find Sam and interview her while she's in custody in northern Syria. That's how we know Samantha's story so far. Eventually, the SDF hands her and the children over to the Americans. They are finally back in the good old US of A. Yeah, we did it. Mission number one accomplished. Ugh, but that was the easy part. Now we need to find out if and to what degree Samantha Sally was culpable in all of this. Because shortly after she arrives back in the good old US of A, she's arrested and charged with, drumroll please, lying to the FBI? What the hell does the FBI have to do with any of this? Plenty, as it turns out. Ahem. The great American lyricist Britney Jean Spears once observed,
"I'm not that innocent."
Turns out she might have been singing about Samantha. Because prior to her time in Syria, she had been an FBI informant back home in America. Yeah, remember Musa's family company ViaDress? Well, the company would ship and deliver goods to people overseas and allow them to establish a US-based address for packaging forwarding. And we're not just talking cutesy little packages of Pokemon cards and My Little Pony figurines. ViaDress would ship brass knuckles, money counting machines, and military gear all over the world. And Homeland Security and the FBI wanted some more deets. So they recruited Samantha to help them gather information on the biz, Musa, and his family. She admits to collecting the requested names, IP addresses, phone numbers, and photographic evidence, then would meet and hand it all over to her FBI handler. I don't have many more precise details about all this because it's classified. However, there are court documents that show that Sam worked with the FBI for more than 2 years, just up until she traveled with Musa to Syria via Turkey in 2015. So that's kind of weird. The feds first arrested and held Samantha Sally for the ambiguous lying to the FBI charge, but they eventually dropped that one, methinks, in order to continue concealing information. But then they charge her with a new count, materially supporting terrorism. So what's up with that? Well, the year leading up to her time in Syria, Samantha took a bunch of cash out of her bank account, then took a quick little money laundering trip to Hong Kong with her children. Then,
oops, she did it again.
A second trip to Hong Kong with more money. Then a third time, she went back with her husband Musa to collect the cash just before the family traveled to Raqqa, Syria. Josh Baker interviews several people close to Sam, including her own sister and father, who both felt that Sam knew way more than she was leading on. Friends said that Musa was manipulative, but Sam could be too. She probably never knew the extent of how far things would go and how bad things could get, but she would do what she needed to gain Musa's affection. So is that it? Was she playing with Musa's heart and simply got lost in the game?
Oh, maybe, baby.
I don't know. I can't speak to what it's like to be in an abusive relationship, and that was absolutely what was happening to Samantha. But there are so many moments looking back that just feel off to me. Like the fact that she was the one behind the camera filming the ISIS propaganda video that featured her son. Or that she told her close friends and Matthew's father, Juan, all different stories about their planned overseas family trip. Each one hearing a different answer to where they were going, for how long, and the purpose of the trip itself. To say the least, the opinions of Samantha from friends and family here in the US are mixed. And to avoid a trial, she pleads guilty to funding terrorism, and she's currently serving a 6-year sentence. Her son Matthew is living with his father Juan, and her 3 other children are living with Samantha's mother and father. The kids are all doing well and have received mental health services after going through this horrific ordeal. Now they have a second chance at a better life. But the story doesn't end there. Josh Baker travels back again to Syria and northern Iraq to hear from people who crossed paths with Samantha while she was living under ISIS control, including the Yazidi boy named Aham. I am haunted by this episode. It's number 4 in the series, titled She's Like My Mother. And in this one, against all odds, Josh Baker tracks down Aham. He too managed to escape Raqqa after the occupation and is now living with his uncle in northern Iraq. The living conditions are horrendous, but this sweet little boy was in high spirits. He was 8 years old during the time he was recording with Josh, and he sings an adorable song into the microphone, proud of his English. Then he recounts the time he made the propaganda video for ISIS alongside Matthew. That's the part that kills me, when you hear this little child matter-of-factly describing how the men put a gun to his head, forcing him to follow exact orders, otherwise, bang, you're dead. This little boy Aham's voice is the sweetest and filled with so much innocence. To hear these words come out of it, man, I can't even tell you. He goes on to describe his time with Samantha, saying she was like a mother to him. After he lost his own family in the genocide years before, he found love and comfort with Sam and the kids. She would sing to them, "You are my sunshine," helping them fall asleep as the bombs dropped down in the distance. When it comes to Aham's account of Samantha, I can't hear any trace of a monster. Nor when Joshua Baker tracks down Sued, the other Yazidi teenage girl who lived in the house and who endured rapes and beatings from Musa. When Josh finds her, she's working as a cleaner and living in a tent on the side of the road. But she's much happier now compared to how bad things used to be. She too misses Samantha and talks about how Samantha would try to protect her from Musa, even at the risk of beatings. Sued speaks with a translator, but you can hear in her voice, she loved Sam, and she doesn't blame her for what Musa did. Sued reasons any of the ISIS men would have treated her like that, and most of the head wives could have treated her like a slave laborer. Instead, Samantha treated her like a daughter, and for that she was grateful. We also hear from a few of Musa's exes back in America who corroborate Sam's account of his ability to brainwash and abuse his partners. Knowing firsthand what Musa was capable of, they believe Sam was completely innocent and was simply making decisions to appease Musa and keep her children safe. Maybe they are right, but the person I found myself agreeing with the most in the series is Samantha's father, Rick Sally, the man who is now helping raise her children. He loves his daughter, he's happy she's home, but he believes she needs to serve her time in prison for her culpability in this mess. I think the 6 years is fair punishment for someone who isn't a monster, but allowed their children to get on a plane overseas with a man who most likely was dabbling in terrorism. I feel confident Sam knew what was going on, based on the fact that she had been collecting evidence for the FBI for the past 2 years and laundered money to Hong Kong. And the way she continued to defend her actions and feign innocence throughout the series was shocking to me. But as much as I found Samantha Sally to be completely reckless and downright deceptive at times, I do think after she serves her 6 years, Samantha deserves a second chance at a happy life. I believe that is fair. What I don't think is fair is what happened to the 3 Yazidi children who lived under the same roof as Sam and Raqqa for over a year. They are not American, so they don't get that chance. Their lives in northern Iraq continue to be in danger. Their only hope is to obtain like a visa to Australia or emigrate to another safe country. Otherwise, their futures there are bleak. And as much as Samantha Sally claims to be the victim, Aham, Sued, and Bedreen are 100% the innocent victims in this story, not the American housewife from Indiana. That's where I land at the end of this sad, enraging story. Ugh, like I said, this series can be very hard at times, but you're gonna feel strong in your convictions by the end. Plus, I also came away with a huge podcast crush on Josh Baker. But alas, I know in reality, a romance would never work out with this guy. He just takes way too many risks. I'd honestly feel safer dating one of those psycho, rope-free rock climbers. But no matter who I end up with, I'll be sure to avoid taking overseas trips with long layovers near terrorist-occupied cities. Thanks! Okay, so if this 10-part series wasn't enough for you, there's also a book called American Girls, One Woman's Journey into the Islamic State and Her Sister's Fight to Bring Her Home, written by a journalist named Jessica Roy. The book is all about Samantha and her sister, Lori Sally. I only read like a 20-page excerpt about their early dating history. And from that, I gathered that this isn't a full-on Team Sam book, but it definitely makes an argument that a long history of domestic abuse in her previous relationships made her more susceptible to Musa's manipulation. I can kind of see it, but I'm very interested to hear what you think of this one. You can email me directly at angela@thetruecrimefeed.com or join the True Crime Feed Facebook discussion group. Keep an open mind and be kind to fellow True Crime Feed friends. Cause the only thing toxic I'll allow is that dope Britney Spears song. Cause I'm addicted to you and crime podcast discussions. Woo! Stay tuned till after the break to hear my top three podcast power ranking of the week. Ah, hey you. I'm so glad we found each other and get to share our special love for true crime podcasts. I don't ever want you to miss out on a wild story. That would be a crime in itself. So be sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on your podcast app and share your favorite episode with a friend so the next time you see each other, you can splurge about your latest true crime obsession. Thanks for spreading the word, and now back to the show. Before we start the ranking, yes, I am still listening to Murder in the Hollywood Hills and finished the final episode of 3. Both were decent this week, but had to face some stiff competition. So here are the 3 shows currently trending that I think are worth a listen. I present you this week's podcast power ranking. At the number 3 spot, we have Serial Season 4. Here's the summary from the show page. Serial returns with a history of Guantanamo told by people who lived through key moments in Guantanamo's evolution. Who know things the rest of us don't know about what it's like to be caught inside an improvised justice system. Just finished episode 3. My expectations were tempered going into the season, but so far I am loving it. I think the tone is perfect. It goes deep. I've seen reviews that say maybe too deep, but not me. I'm not one of them. I want the whole story, all the dark, scandalous, and surprisingly hilarious parts. I found Ahmed's story to be particularly fascinating, and I'm very interested to see how things turn out for him, plus more of the dark, seedy, unheard tales from Gitmo in Serial Season 4. At the number 2 spot, we have Hello, John Doe. Here's a reminder from the show page. At age 45, Steve Patterson made a shocking online discovery. His own missing persons page. Desperate to uncover why he had been included on this list, Steve called Todd Matthews, a missing persons investigator in search of answers. Together, Todd and Steve discover a sordid family past that includes long-lost relatives, kidnappings, and murders. Hello, John Doe is a winding, poignant tale that explores what it means to be lost and found. The series finale dropped yesterday. No spoilers, but I am shaken up. If you listened to the first few but dipped out, it is worth your time to tune in to episode 10. Listen to the whole thing because you get a detail in the last few minutes that will change everything. And then afterwards, come find me in the True Crime Feed Facebook discussion group because we need to spoiler talk all about Hello, John Doe. And at the number 1 spot, we have Beyond All Repair. Here's a synopsis from the show page. Imagine you're accused of something horrific. You swear you didn't do it, but someone says they witnessed it. Your own brother. Sophia Johnson was newly married with a baby on the way when she became the prime suspect in her mother-in-law's brutal murder. Armory Stevenson re-examines a case unsolved, a family torn apart, and the woman who wasn't believed. Ugh, you guys, this is so good. If there was a ranking higher than number one, I would give it to this show. This comes to us from the same team that brought us Violation, a show I plan on doing a deep dive in the future. So I was super excited for this show to come out. I heard rumblings that it was good, but I wanted to wait for more episodes to come out so I can binge a bunch at once. Oh man, this one blew me out of the water. I raced through the first 6 episodes. It's so addictive and bingeable. But honestly, I almost wish that I waited to listen to all 10 at once because having to wait a week in between is agony. You are gonna be obsessed when you tune in to Beyond All Repair. Now for my miss of the week. We have Paper Ghosts Season 4, The Ozarks. Here's the rundown from the show page. It's the dead of summer in 1989 in the heart of the Ozarks. An 18-year-old woman goes missing from Bella Vista, Arkansas. As the search moves forward, several suspects emerge. Then a body is found, not far from the Missouri border, and a homicide investigation begins. Soon, a second body is discovered nearby. What was a mystery transforms into the hunt for a possible serial killer stalking young women throughout the Ozarks. All right, are you a monster if you like this? No. We can totally still be friends. I know a lot of people are really into this one. I liked the first season of Paper Ghosts, but as new seasons have dropped, I found the show, and in particular host M. William Phelps, to have diminishing returns. I know, he's written a lot of books, and he's clearly a very important person who starts his name with an initial. But I keep zoning out and losing the plot of this story, so I no longer believe in paper ghosts. Therefore, I'm gonna make it disappear down my podcast queue trapdoor. I hope this decision doesn't come back to haunt me later. Find out next week if Beyond All Repair will remain in the number one spot as the series continues, or if a new show will swoop in and take its place. Let me know what trending shows are in your top 3 and what show fell through your podcast queue trapdoor. I'll meet you back here next week to dust off another superb true crime show from the archive for your next feeding fix. That's all for today's True Crime Feed. Don't forget to sign up for my weekly newsletter where I post links to my top 3 favorite shows of the week and bring you fabulous visual aids for every episode. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook to join the conversation. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave a review and tell your fellow partners in crime to tune in to True Crime Feed. It's a huge help to grow the show, and it means the world. So thanks for riding along and allowing me to be your audio accomplice. Join me next week for another feeding.